Okay, please come with me to Job chapter 3. Now, this is the second Bible study I've prepared today. The first one I prepared, I finished halfway through this afternoon, and I thought, felt very convicted about the study. I thought, I need to preach this on Sunday. So, this isn't the study I prepared. The study I prepared, I'll preach on Sunday. Because my plan was to follow up this Wednesday what I preached about on Sunday. Sunday we're talking about the God of wonders, the God of the corkscrew, and I was going to follow it up with some more thoughts and applications for us. And having prepared it, I thought, no, we'll follow it up on the Lord's Day. So this is a second study. And one of the things we looked at on Sunday was Job and what Job suffered. And so we simply call this study, When Tragedy Strikes. And we're just going to look at a little snapshot very early on in the book of Job, understanding Job and understanding how Job is not to be comforted as well as how he ought to be comforted. So look, come with me to Job chapter 3. Now, how do we find Job as we come to chapter 3? Well, he's sitting on the city rubbish heap. He's lost his wealth, his reputation, his health. He's lost his children. Unbearable, isn't it? And there's nothing left, really. He's lost everything. And there's the temptation, in the words of his wife, in chapter 2, verse 9, to curse God and die. You've lost everything. There's no point in living anymore. What's the point of wrestling on? But he's resisted that temptation. But we need to remember, as we look at Job, as we come to chapter 3, this is, as we said on Sunday, innocent suffering, isn't it? We read in chapter 1, verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. So he's unique, isn't he? Fears God. He shuns evil. And he's the one man in the world who is careful to avoid judgment. We know when his children go feasting. We read verse 5 of chapter 1, so it was when the days of their feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all, for Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. So he's the man who is bending over backwards to avoid offending God. And of course, as we thought too in chapter 2, verse 3, God himself acknowledges that this is innocent suffering. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. God says, this is an innocent man. Now, as we come to chapter 3, Job is joined by his three friends. And if you know the book, the expression Job's comforters, who needs friends like these? But they've genuinely come to comfort him. They haven't come to make his life a misery, which is actually what they do, but they've come to comfort him. And at the end of chapter 2, they're shocked at Job's appearance, verse 12. And then we read in the ritual morning of the day, chapter 2, verse 12, they lifted up their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. So that's where we are. Job with his three friends, they've come to comfort him. And then as we come to chapter 3, Job now speaks. After this, Job opened his mouth. He now speaks. What will he say? And as we look at chapter 3, we're looking into the heart of Job, aren't we? After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said, may the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. May that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. And it goes on like that until verse 10. Says Job, I wish I'd never been born. Maybe look at verses 11 onwards. He says, why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why do the knees receive me, or why do the breasts, or why the breasts that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. Then I would have been at rest. And so it goes on like that until verse 15. It says, Job, I wish I'd died at birth. I wish I'd never been born. I wish I'd died at birth. Verse 16, or why was I not hidden like a stillborn child, like infants who never saw light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. And it goes on like that till verse 19. He says, I wish I was stillborn. I wish I'd miscarried. And then verse 20. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave? He's saying, why can't I die now? And verse 23, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? If God is against me, why am I allowed to live on? And then verses 24 and 25, for my sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water, for the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes. Says Job, this is my ultimate nightmare. So it's pretty strong stuff, isn't it, chapter 3? He speaks for the first time. He says, I wish I'd never been born. Curse the day I was born. He then goes on to say, I wish I'd died at birth. Then he says, well, I wish I'd been stillborn. I wish I'd been miscarried. Well, none of those things happen, so why can't I die now? If God is against me, why doesn't he just finish me off? Why am I allowed to live on? And all that's happened to me is my ultimate nightmare. I have no rest, for trouble comes. Let me die. Now, chapter 3, is there any light at the end of that tunnel? It's about as dark as you can get, isn't it? There is no light anywhere. And therefore, as you come to Job, Job is the oldest book in the Bible. There's no real sense that Job has of an afterlife, is there, at this stage, certainly? He doesn't say, well, it'll all be right in the life to come. Just, when he talks about the dead, he talks about in terms of when the dead die, they're oblivion. There's oblivion, they're at rest, they're not troubled anymore. It's the end. So there's no light at the end of his tunnel, no sense of things are going to be put right in the world to come. And what we're looking into is the heart of a suffering man. Now, up until now, there's been that 7 days, up until now, he's been too stunned to speak. We're told, aren't we, 7 days, 7 nights, no one spoke a word to him. He's not speaking to them, and they don't speak to him. He's been sitting there in stunned silence. But now he's beginning to take in what's happened to him. He's beginning to assimilate it. It's beginning to dawn on him all that's taken place. And it's unbearable, isn't it? And the pressure of his grief is unsupportable. He can't take any more. It's like a wall, isn't there? The wall of a dam, and the water is rising behind it. The water of his grief, and it's just getting more and more, and the pressure's greater and greater. And then as you come to chapter 3, the wall just collapses, and out pours his grief in this one long articulate scream. That's all it is. It's just a scream, isn't it? I mean, it's beautiful poetry, and he expresses things in a wonderful way, but it's just a scream of anguish, a scream of grief. And if you look at what he says in chapter 3, there's no reflection. It's not reflecting in that sense, and he's not trying to work things out. There's no attempt of understanding what's taken place. At times what Job says, he's completely irrational. How can you curse the day of your birth? It doesn't make any sense, does it? It's an irrational thing to say. But he just collapses under the weight of his grief. So what can we learn about God's people when tragedy strikes? I'll throw that out. Looking at chapter 3. What do we learn about God's people when tragedy strikes? We'll learn something about ourselves, because tragedy will strike our lives at some time. And we'll learn something about those we love and are nearest to us when tragedy strikes them. Yes? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely spot on, Abby. That's it, isn't it? I mean, when God's people are in anguish, they say all sorts of things, don't they? They say things without any sort of theological underpinning. They say things which aren't true. They say things which aren't in the Bible. They say things which they've never been taught. They say things which are completely irrational. They say all those things, don't they? They don't reflect about what they're talking about. They just want to escape the pain and die. God's people do that. And as you say, Abby, they often say things they don't actually believe. But in that moment, that's all they can see. They're not deserting God. It's just what grief does. It's what tragedy does to people. That's what God's people do under those circumstances. So that's one thing, isn't it, we learn? We learn that people in great distress, they scream. And they say things without any Bible verses or underpinning. And they say things which don't make sense. And they just want the pain to stop. And they say, why can't I die? Now, we don't say they haven't got faith or they're not trusting in God. They're just saying that's just what people do. And Job is not rebuked for that, is he? He's still trusting in God, as the book goes on to show. So God's people do that, don't they? Anything else that we can learn about the timing of this in chapter 3? What do we learn about how God's people sometimes face tragedy, the timing of it? Yes, that's a very good point, isn't it? If God removes the hedge, what might happen to any of us? It's only the God's restraining hand, isn't it? It's multi-layered, isn't it? At one level, it's natural causes, winds blow, it's people doing wickedly, the Chaldeans coming and kidnapping and killing. At another level, it's satanic. There's another level, it's ultimately the Lord. You incited me, he says to Satan. You incited me against Job, but this is actually God's doing. So, yeah. But, sorry. Yes, indeed. Yes. Find security in things which aren't secure. Yeah, that's right. Thank you. What about this sense of, they sit for 7 days, then he speaks. Is there any significance about the 7 days? I don't mean the significance of number seven. I mean, just the fact these things have happened, he's sitting there for 7 days. If we think about God's people facing tragedy, what sometimes happens when tragedy strikes them?
Sometimes takes a long time for it to come to
turn. Yeah. Sometimes tragedy strikes someone, and initially you think they're okay. Not okay. You think, well, they're bearing up well. The Lord's supporting them. The Lord's keeping them. But actually, what's happened is that they haven't yet taken in just what's happened. Someone's been married 50 years. Sorry, Mike, I'll be in a minute. Hang on. Someone's been married 50 years, and they lose a husband or a wife. You go and see them the first few days, and they're bearing up sometimes. You see, the Lord's undertaking. Well, that's true, the Lord is undertaking. But you go back in 6 months, or in a month, and life is unbearable, because they're just beginning to see the fact, I'm never going to see him again in this world. I'm never going to see her again. The house is empty. It's no longer a home for me, it's just a place where I live. And even though they prepared themselves for, maybe they know someone's going to be preparing themselves for maybe months, because it's an illness, and they know what's going to happen. I'll turn around and say, nothing ever, ever prepared me for this. Because sometimes it takes time for these things to be assimilated. Okay, so there's two things. When people go through grief, they will say things which don't make any sense. And it sounds like, and it's the grief speaking. And also, you won't necessarily initially see the full impact. It's the days, it's the weeks, it's the months as it begins to strike them what it is that's happened. Sorry, Mike, yeah. That's right, and that's the That's the thing, as the book goes on, he keeps running to God, doesn't he? He's like and he wants to have a meeting with God. Yeah, thank you. There's one final thing to say, I think, about this. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Actually, you don't need to turn to it. I'll just read that, because it's just half a verse I want to read. It says, verse 11 says, "For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of a man which is in him?" Okay? In other words, the only one who really knows what Job is going through is Job. And when tragedy strikes, there's a sense in which none of us can ever enter into the grief of another. Now, you know what I'm saying, because there are some who've been through the same experience, and they are a great help in those times, because they can empathise, they can sympathise. But there's a sense for us all, isn't there? Only we know our own grief. And no one can enter into what Job is going through. Only Job knows Job's pain. Okay, so just put those things together for when you're helping people in tragedy, and maybe when tragedy strikes you. Okay? Things are irrational. There's no theological underpinning. Things are just said. We scream about things and we just want to die because it's too painful. And sometimes it takes a time for things to drop, for the pain to drop, to see what's going on and to understand it. And also there's a sense in which only the person themselves really can enter into what they've gone through, because they know their pain. Okay, so here's Job. He's you know, when tragedy strikes people, they sometimes feel they're losing their mind. That's why when you talk to them, it sounds like they're losing their mind. But it's just the grief. And Job collapses under a weight of sorrows. Okay, so throws then, how then can we help such people? Okay, so Eliphaz will now speak as we come to chapter 4. I'm going to move through these chapters very quickly because of time. Now Eliphaz speaks. He's the first of Job's friends to speak. He's genuinely trying to help. He wants to make things better. If you read the speeches in Job, it's the kindest of the speeches. This is the kindest of the speeches. They get worse and worse. But listen to his speech and see if you think he's helping Job, if it's a comfort to Job. All right? Because it'll help us as we seek to comfort others, won't we? Because if we think, Eliphaz, that's not very comforting, then maybe I ought not to do it. And if Eliphaz has missed things that he should be saying, maybe we take that to heart as well. Okay, so chapter 4, verse 2, he says, "If one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking?" Job, I just got to speak. Okay, we've been sitting here 7 days in silence. I'm just going to have to speak now, Job. All right, I'm going to have to break the silence. And then verses 3 to 5, "Job, you've helped so many. Now it's your turn to be helped." Verse 6, "Is not your reverence your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" What is he saying? He's saying, look, Job, you lived a good life. You're a good man, Job. You're a man of integrity. So, because you're a good man, Job, God won't let you down. Okay? God doesn't desert good men. Job, God won't desert you. These troubles are only temporary, Job. Okay? There's light at the end of the tunnel. Verse 7. "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright ever cut off? So Job, you're a good man, so God will restore you. It'll be all right." He says that in verses 8 to 11, God does punish the guilty, but you're not among the wicked of the earth, Job. He'll begin to change his tune as he goes through the book of Job. At this stage, he's being very, you know, winning and warm. Okay, so he's saying, Job, this is temporary. God won't let you down. All right, Job. All right, Eliphaz, you said that. So how does Eliphaz explain what's going on? How does he explain this suffering? Well, the first thing is to ask the question is, where does he get his explanation from? It's quite interesting. He says, verse 12, "Now a word was secretly brought to me, and my ear received a whisper of it. In disquieting thoughts, from visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, fear came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones shake. Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair on my body stood up. I stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. Then I heard a voice saying." Okay, so where's Eliphaz got his answer from? He's got some big insights here. Where does he get them from? Yes, it's a sort of dream. It's a sort of mystical, mysterious spiritual experience. It's almost as though some sort of spirit has come in the night and whispered in his ear. And he looked and he couldn't see anything, but then he heard a voice. It's some sort of experience he's had, yeah? Personal word from God, if you like, through a shadowy spiritual experience. Well, what did he learn from this vision? Well, we're told, verse 17, can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? If he puts no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is the dust, who are crushed before a moth? What's he saying? He's saying, Job, no one's pure, not even the angels. And therefore, this spirit, this spectre told me that all men are sinners. So God chastens all men. Okay, that's what he's saying. What's happening to you, Job? Well, we're all sinners. God chastens all men. Then chapter 5, verse 1. He says, Job, by all means call out, but don't call to the angels. And verse 2, careful what you say, Job, in case you say something that you shouldn't. And then in verses 3 to 6 of chapter 5, he says, life's full of troubles. I've seen people lose everything. But it doesn't just happen, Job. There's a reason behind all these things. Verse 7, yet man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. He's saying, look, Job, man's lot in this world is one of trouble. Okay? Everyone's a sinner. Therefore, man's experience in this world is that of trouble, of loss, of tragedy, of disaster. We're all sinners in various guises and ways, and this is what God's way of dealing with his world. Okay? That's what he's saying. So he's not actually at the moment really nailing Job and saying, you're the terrible sinner. Just saying, we're all sinners, you know, and God chastens us and deals with us, and that's what's going on, Job. And so he goes on a bit more personal now. So he says, chapter 5, verse 8, putting myself in your shoes, Job, as for me, I would speak to God. Sorry, I would seek God, beg your pardon, and to God I would commit my cause. All right? So what I do, Job, if it's the way God's dealing with you, you know what to do, Job? Seek God. Trust yourself into his hands. Okay, verse 11. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. So if you humble yourself before God, he'll lift you up. Sure, in this world, Job, the guilty get their comeuppance. But Job, you'll be okay, because we've said, you know, you're a good man, and God won't let you down. Verse 15. He saves the needy from the sword. Verse 16. So the poor have hope. Verse 17, behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. So you see what he's saying? Okay, we're all sinners. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly outward, you know, bonfire and then the sparks go outward. That's what man's life is like. We're all sinners, not even the angels. You know, he charges the angels with folly. How much more then will he charge we who are made of the clay with our sin? So God is chastening you. Well, you know, Job, it's a good thing that God chastens you, isn't it? Happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, don't despise the chastening of the Lord. Humble yourself before him. It'll be all right. This is a temporary chastening. God is reproving you. Praise the Lord. This is working for your good. Job, let the chastening have its work, and everything will be fine in the end. And then he finishes with this real sort of flourish at the end. We won't have time to look at all, but just say from verse 18. For he bruises, but he binds up. He wounds, but his hands make whole. He shall deliver you in 6 troubles. Yes, in 7 no evil shall touch you. In famine he shall redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the scourge of the tongue, and you shall not be afraid of destruction when it comes. You'll laugh at destruction and famine. And so he goes on. In other words, there are better times coming. After this chastening, all will be well. And then he goes on to verse 26. Verse 25 will take it. You shall also know that your descendants shall be many, and your offspring, your children, like the grass of the earth. You shall come to the grave at a full age, as a sheaf of grain ripens in its season. Behold, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear it and know it for yourself. Okay? You know what I'm saying is true, Job. Okay, Job, happy days are just round the corner. God is chastening you. But when that work is done, everything will be fine. You'll die an old man after a long, full, satisfied life. I know the wicked are punished, Job, but you're not among the wicked. You're a good man. This is temporary chastening. Seek God. All's well that ends well. Okay? That's what he's saying. Now, when you read that, you hear echoes of what you might say to someone in tragedy, mightn't you? You know, God is chastening you. It'll be all right in the end. Seek the Lord. Trust in him. Yeah? All things work together for good. Right? We might say all those things, mightn't we? It all sounds Eliphaz-like, isn't it? But it's no comfort to Job in this situation, is it? What's wrong with it? First of all, is it true what Eliphaz says is the cause of Job's suffering? It's not true, is it? So what's wrong with what Eliphaz is saying? Yes. That's right. And if there was a sense in which God is just dealing with you, Job, as he deals with all sinners, you'd have to say, well, yeah, but Job's been singled out, hasn't he? Job isn't suffering like other people. So it's not good Eliphaz saying to him, look, you know, it's just part of suffering in this world. All men are sinners. We're all born to trouble. That doesn't explain why Job's been singled out. His explanation doesn't stack up, does it? It's not a good explanation. And it's not surprising because his authority, the source of his explanation, is his strange mystical experience that he's had. Yeah? Again, we've got to be careful, haven't we? I'm sure you've been in situations where someone says, oh, God's given me a word for you. Have you had that? And you've been in distress, you've been in difficulty. Well, sometimes a God's word has been a word in season. It's been great. Other times you think, where did you get that from? All right? So be careful. But what is it about the spirit of what Eliphaz says? And maybe that's the thing we can learn best as we're trying to help people in tragedy. Listen to what he says, right? Just listen. Just think about it. You're Job sitting there, all right? You've just lost everything, including your children. Listen to what Eliphaz says. Verse 8. But as for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause. Or verse 17, behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Verse 25, don't you think verse 25 is really tactless? You shall also know that your descendants shall be many, and your offspring like the grass of the earth. Job, you'll have loads more children. And then verse 26, you shall come to the grave at a full age as a sheaf of grain ripens in its season. What is it about Eliphaz that really is, gets, you know, you can imagine Job sitting there thinking, what? He doesn't really understand, does he? No, go on. Patronite doesn't understand him. Anything else that you want to throw at Eliphaz? He's not here. You said it, throw anything you like at him. That's right. No. It's all those things, isn't it? And, you know, it is incredible. Happy is the man whom God corrects. Job, this is blessing. And the thing about it all is, isn't it? And that's it, this sort of sense of, as for me, if I was in your shoes, Job, this is what I would do. Isn't that the height of arrogance? The fact is, he's not in Job's shoes, is he? He's gone through none of this. You know, the thing which strikes you is that Eliphaz isn't suffering. But he's saying, Job, if I was in your shoes, this is what I do. Eliphaz isn't suffering. But he turns around to Job and says, what a blessing you're having, Job. You must be so happy to go through this chastening. God is doing you good. Eliphaz isn't suffering. But he says, but Job, it'll all turn out fine in the end. It'll all be happy. All's well that ends well. Things can only get better. Behold, this we have searched out. It's true. Hear it and know for yourself. So can you see? Just actually, some things that Eliphaz says are true, aren't they? But just the whole spirit, the whole manner, the whole approach. Here's a man who's not going through the things that Job is going through, but seeks to speak to Job and explain to Job and prescribe for Job just how to handle it and what's going on and what to do. So just rewinding, how do we help people when tragedy strikes? Okay? Okay, the obvious first question we ask is what I say true? Because what Eliphaz says isn't true, is it? Doesn't explain the fact that Job's been singled out. But if you're thinking about the spirit in which Eliphaz speaks, what spirit then should we speak with those who are going through tragedy? Yes, Paul. Yes, that's very good. And it ties in, doesn't it? It's interesting what it says in chapter 4, verse 2. It says, if one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking? So Eliphaz breaks the silence, doesn't he? He says, I've got things to say to you, Job. So he doesn't even let Job break the silence. He breaks it. Thank you, Paul. It's very helpful to listening. Anything else? Yes.
Well, yes. Not a good starting point.
No, not very comforting, is it? What if you feel God's turned against you? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, as though you're suffering with them. Yeah, worse.
No,
yeah. Yes, that's right. It's very helpful. So what you're saying is they're trying to pull Job to be where they are, but actually they should be sitting where Job is. Yes. Yeah. That's Romans 12:15, isn't it? And that's it. That's saying it, isn't it? Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. What's the shortest verse of the Bible? Jesus wept. And you know, there is a place for explanations, isn't there? But therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So he enters in, doesn't he? In all our afflictions he was afflicted, it says. Okay, so as we seek to help people when tragedy strikes, we could ask, you know, if I do speak, then obviously what do I say? Is what I say true? But we mustn't think that we know. And we must remember that we're not the ones who are suffering. And if there is anything to say, well, it should be the comfort of the scriptures. And the key thing probably is, as we've said, when these things happen, the time is not now for answers, is there? The time is simply to stand with them, to weep with them, to sit with them. You know, as Simon said, we're not trying to pull them to where we are and for them to see what we see, because we're not. How can we presume that? Because we're not going through what they're going through. It's for us to go and sit with them, and just sit with them and weep with them. And have no explanations. And not try and be, you know, try and reason this one out or reason this one through. Time will come for that. As long as all we do is, Eliphaz breaks the silence, but he never says, "Job, I'm so sorry," does he? "I'm so sorry, Job." And sometimes that's the greatest thing, isn't it? Just to sit with people, to weep with them, to hold their hand, to touch them, to put our arm around them, just to sit with them in the room. And they may say all sorts of things that don't make any sense at all, and we're not there to say, "Oh no, you can't say that," and that, "Well, I know that," and then we just simply listen and weep with them, because actually that's what we need to do, and that's of course what Christ did. And here you have, isn't it? This is the kindest speech that Job listens to. And it's of no comfort at all to a man whose heart is breaking. Well, as we close, obviously, we have a comfort that Job at that point couldn't see. We can see the life beyond. There is a very real sense that there's a great comfort in that. You know, our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. We don't look at the things which are seen, which are temporary, but the things which are not seen, which are eternal. We can do that. But of course, supremely, we can see Jesus. What you get in Job time and time again are Christ-shaped holes. Because Job is longing for someone like Christ. Well, in fact, he's longing for Christ to come along and to fill that hole. He longs for a mediator. He longs for someone who would understand him. He longs for someone who would comfort him. He longs for someone to sit with him and know and feel and understand what he's going through. And there is no one. And there are all these Christ-shaped holes or silhouettes in Job. And he leaves the space and says, if only there was someone like that. And we can come along and say, yes, but there is. And we have what Job at that stage didn't have and couldn't see. We have Christ. And of course, Christ suffered as no one has ever suffered. And he really was the one true innocent, wasn't he? His really was innocent suffering. And he suffered as no one has ever, ever suffered. He's forsaken by God, put to grief by Abba Father. He's described as a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Doesn't mean he went around looking morose. It meant that all the worst of living in this cursed, wretched, dying, grief-stricken world, he experienced it at its worst, at every stage, at every dimension. And of course, he experienced the ultimate nightmare. And then we discover that he's the friend who sits closer than a brother. And we discover that he's the friend who grieves with us, and grieves to see us grieving, and comes and weeps with us when we're weeping, who shares in all our heartaches, who, one like Eliphaz, can say, I know, I understand, I have been through that myself, and I know what it's like. And the one who is one of us, who is flesh and blood, who has been made of the clay, and he hasn't thrown away his human nature, he's still a man, he still understands. One who cannot but sympathize with us in all our heartaches and tragedies, and who can in time give us peace without any explanations. Sometimes we feel my peace will come when I get an answer. And Job learns that peace comes often without an answer. God can give us peace directly without any answers at all. It's the peace that passes all understanding. And he's the Christ whose grace is sufficient. And he's a Jesus who one day will wipe away all our tears himself. So, maybe just a little insight. When tragedy strikes, it may happen to me. Sometime in life it'll happen to all of us, won't it? And it'll happen to those who are near to us. We perhaps know a little better what to expect, and perhaps a little better how we may help one another when that time comes.